everybody. Adam Shartoff, host of Film Wax Radio, and this is episode number 475 of the podcast. I hope everybody's well, and as I record this, it is April the 9th. This is a great episode you're about to hear. It's we have two segments. We have a first up here is Aaron West, who is the host of Criterion Now. If you go to CriterionCast.com, you can find the Criterion Now podcast on there. Criterion Cast is a number of different podcasts which are centered on the Criterion Collection, of course. So this is like the first one here with this terrific host and really knowledgeable cinephile. His name again, Aaron West, and he'll be up in just a little bit. And we're going to talk to a filmmaker who's got a new documentary called Home and Away, and his name is Matt Ogens, and we will be talking to him in just a bit. But first, I want to go into this conversation with Aaron. I was on the Criterion Now podcast not long ago, just about a month ago. And so what we did, Aaron and I decided to do, was a little bit of a back-to-back approach to it. So first we recorded his podcast. That was episode number 48 on the podcast, where we talked about Silence of the Lambs and Wim Wenders and much more. So go check out Criterion Now. Subscribe to the podcast if you are indeed into the Criterion Collection or just into film in general. And then you can hear Aaron on today's show. So let's get into it right now. This is my conversation with South Carolina son, Mr. Aaron, not Adam, but Aaron West, here on Film Wax Radio.
Your eyelids are getting heavy. Hard to live. Your mind begins to wander. Things start to drift. Your arms are getting heavy. Hard to lift. You sink down a little deeper. And you're feeling wonderful. Feeling wonderful. Maybe you're falling in love.
So for those listening, this is Aaron West, who is the host of the Criterion Now podcast. What episode are you up to, by the way?
48. I don't know when this will come out, but we're almost to our 50th. This is just a show we started last year, so it's just about weekly, as you can tell.
Yeah.
But we used to do Criterion Close-Up, and we're part of Criterion Cast, so very Criterion-centric podcast.
Is Criterion Cast pretty much weekly, and you're coming up to your 50th episode?
Yeah, it's been a little more than a year. We started in January last year, so yeah.
And the Criterion Cast, is that a network of podcasts?
It is. Criterion Cast is also old school, so I think Ryan Gallagher started it probably about the time that FilmWax started, and he's been pretty much the go-to, not just podcast-wise, but on the web, too. He breaks a lot of news, and the website has a lot of written content, too. So, yeah, I think we're probably the team for Criterion content. At least I like to think so.
So there's how many are in this network?
Well, it's pretty vast.
Okay.
But not. It's really now about maybe three or four shows, but there have been a number of shows throughout its entire run. So we had a show called Criterion Close-Up, where we would pick a topic. Like, we did one on David Lynch and Mulholland Drive, or PTA, or maybe like the Road Trilogy. We didn't do the Road Trilogy.
But that's an example of something you might have done.
Something we might have done. And we put an episode up. They still do titles. I say they because I don't have enough time to do them all with them, but they'll do, say, a Criterion title a month and have a few people on, and there's other shows. We actually just did an episode on the Winter Olympic box set,
right.
So the Olympic set, but only the winter titles, so that was fun. Yeah, it's a good community.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine, like many things, the cream rises in terms of the quality of whatever, because I'm sure a lot of film lovers think, oh, what greater type of show to do, but a Criterion show oriented around Criterion, and maybe, you know, it's an excuse to get all of them, and but it's a ton of work. It requires, I imagine it's just a ton of work for you.
You know, it's actually not that bad. I mean, basically, I kind of gravitate to more art, classic art house film, and foreign art house film, which, so Criterion is pretty much gives me a good pick of the litter. You know, basically, if you're looking for the best, I don't know, Fellini or Bergman or Satyajit Ray transfer, you're going to find it in home media in America. So I end up buying these things anyway, or watching them on Filmstruck or however. So it's kind of just an extension of what I already do. I just love film and I love talking about film. So fortunately, a few people listen and they enjoy hearing about it. So it's just my thing. I don't know if I mentioned this before, but a few years ago, my wife won Jeopardy, and so we then decided to buy the entire Criterion Collection, which is like a film nerd's dream.
Wait a minute, she won Jeopardy. Okay, so there was you. Do you already own a house?
Yeah.
How much money did she win? Can you say that much? I know Uncle Sam takes a chunk out of it, but that's significant. So you walked out with roughly half of that, right?
It was about $25,000.
Oh, that's significant. So you walked out with roughly half of that, right?
Well, at the time, we didn't do it in one fell swoop.
Why is that?
Which is actually, our mailman is probably pleased. Although we became on very good terms with our mailman for a good year.
Why is that?
But because we kept on buying Criterions. So I think at that point, I had maybe 50 to 100.
No, but I'm slowing it down. I want to know, when was she on Jeopardy?
2014. So it was.
That's recent.
So yeah, pretty recent. 3 years ago.
Okay.
And on the plane ride home, in the airport, actually, as we were leaving LA, I said, "Hey, honey, I'm happy for you. Can I buy the Criterion Collection?"
Because this was a long dormant fantasy. What if we came into a shitload of money, and I could just go and buy the entire Criterion Collection?
So yeah. We could pay down the mortgage. We could buy a new car. But no, I want to buy a bunch of discs that may not be obsolete.
Yeah,
might be wasted money. The jury's out on that one.
Yeah. Well,
so I have a good wife.
So you just and she said yes, ostensibly.
She said yes.
And this is great because actually even by 2014 or so, there's been just this tremendous. Great amount they've acquired just so much great stuff already. Okay, how do you go about acquiring the Criterion Collection?
That was the next problem. So you can't just go to a store. Well, I guess you could go to a Barnes & Noble because they tend to have most everything in stock. So you can't just logistically buy the entire collection. I do remember part of why I thought this was because there was one time where Amazon.com sold the entire collection for like $5,000 or something. This is probably going back a good 10 years or so. And a lot of that was DVD before they got into Blu-ray. Sure. And I remember looking at that and I didn't have $5,000 at the time. So I thought, not that I just have $5,000 laying around, but that I could spend. But I thought, how great would it be just to have that disposable income and get this? So that didn't exist. So what we had to do is had to just fill in the gaps, and I didn't want to go broke. You know, I didn't want to spend all of her $25,000. I wanted to be responsible. So I would wait for sales, and so there's generally 4 sales per year. There's 2 flash sales. So that's one from Criterion. They'll cut all the prices from their own website 50%, and so what's $40 is $20. And then there's Barnes & Noble, which does the same for the entire months of July and October. And I think it's November, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I would just...
That makes sense, getting ready for Christmas.
Holidays. So those months, my mailman was a fixture at my house. So I would be getting huge packages. And I remember there's a big community for Criterion Collection. And so I would get these massive shipments, and I would just stack them up and take pictures. And when I think about it now... It was maybe a little bit of braggadocio, the aesthetic of seeing.
Yeah. Well, I did that when I went into the closet, you know, last summer or something? I think it was the summer. No, it was 2 summers ago. I'm guessing 2016, I think. And they just said, I may have the timeline wrong, I said, tell me how much I can get because. But the difference was a couple of things. One, they weren't really they would get directors come in, visiting directors, and they would go in and they would videotape it. They would shoot it and they would put up as a promotional thing. They weren't doing that with me. So wasn't like anybody could see what I was going to get. You know, they took some pictures, but that was on my request. So I could probably get more than most people would get, you know, knowing they, I'm not going to be filmed. I could be a little bit more greedy, you know, and not self-conscious about it. No shame. But I said, no, give me a number because, you know, seriously, I would be, you know, I might get out of control once it's like a frenzy. So I said, well, you know, 10 things. And I slipped in a couple of box sets, you know. And I felt so guilty about it, but I was like, couldn't believe it. So I want to, we talked on, we just, for those listening, we just did Aaron's, the Criterion Now podcast, and we talked about the Apu trilogy, the Sajit Ray, and that was one of the things I grabbed, and the BBS box was another one.
Great choices.
Coveting for ages. And then things like, a couple of other things we talked about, I grabbed Paris, Texas might have been one, and American Friend. I may be wrong about some of that, but it was like all these things that I've been wanting. But here's a case where you don't have to discriminate. It's like you just grab everything in the closet.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what you're doing.
Some people have done that. The Safdie brothers and Barry Jenkins were both shamelessly greedy in the closet.
The Safdies did that?
They came out with stacks, yeah. So.
Are you serious? Are there any of their films on the... I said, are you serious? And Siri came alive.
That's funny.
That's shocking to me. But they don't. Do they have any films on there?
No, but I think they. Well, Barry Jenkins has done a Filmstruck, interview. Okay. And the Safdies did a little kind of mini documentary, about an hour long documentary about their films. So I think they have a connection. And I think Criterion is fine with it. They're promoting themselves by putting these people in the closet. And, you know, if the price of 30 discs to get Barry Jenkins an Oscar winning director.
Sure. Well, even 30, it's a lot, but it's not like the entire one copy of everything in the closet. I mean, that's nuts. But
10 discs got Adam Shartoff to promote their show.
Well, no, it was just such a joy. And then I did put pictures of me up on it, thinking, well, I'm just so excited about it. I want to share it. But it was bragging, you know. But what you guys did was a different thing. Now, here was an opportunity. I don't know. You didn't maybe think about it. Did you think about getting in touch with Criterion directly?
Well, no, because a lot of people do that. There's actually this little group called Completionists.
Yeah.
It's kind of a joking name, but there is... People, and I think Criterion, their business model is very savvy. They lend themselves to collectors.
Makes sense.
Might collect stamps or baseball cards. You put a number on a disc, and you carefully curate what's there.
Right.
And people are going to buy it. So there are actually a lot of people. So I started blogging about them, but now I talk about them.
Right. No, but it just sort of made sense. Like it could be, I just won Jeopardy and I'm spending money on the Criterion. That to me, if I worked at Criterion, I would think this is a great marketing opportunity. It's a newsworthy thing. So, but
yeah,
I'm mentioning this
maybe
years
missed
later.
Opportunity. I should have reached out to him, but I didn't know him at the time. I'm a little closer to them now.
Of course. Yeah. But if I were your agent, I might've been able to. And then you might have gotten some stuff.
I should have hired you, Adam.
But since then, do they know who you are? Do they know about the podcast? Have you had interaction with the folks there? Because it's such a thoughtful and thorough and, you know, frankly, it's like a promotional a component, I would think, for them. It's that level of expertise I think you have.
So yes and no. They know me. I've been there a couple times, uninvited.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You've crashed?
Our team has been there a couple times with Peter and a couple members. I could have, I think, if I had just been able to find a time to make an appointment, that sort of thing, when I was in New York. But yeah, I'm on the press list. I've spoken with them. I know some employees. I keep a few secrets. Our community is very very curious about what's coming out next. And,
you sometimes get it. You get a lead.
Sometimes I'll get a little inside info that I'll keep to myself. We did this thing called a blogathon a couple years ago, and I know that they were very thrilled about that because they actually told me what we did is we organized a bunch of blogs on the internet to just write about Criterion for a month, and we made a big deal about it on social media. And they ended up posting about it on their website.
That's great.
And just personally, I was told that they were pretty much to the top. They were very thrilled.
Well, you have an organized now, you have like an actual community with real reach. It makes sense that they would want to exploit that, of course, on some level, you know, and I don't mean that in a negative way.
I think they're pretty careful with the way they communicate things. Yeah. So yes, they do know us, and that I know secondhand that they know us, and firsthand from my own communications. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they chew up every episode. Now I will say that there's another label in the UK, that Arrow Video, and they're in the US as well. And I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they do a little bit of art house. But
through your show.
Oh, thanks. A lot of grindhouse horror. They're actually, I'd say that they're probably the second best home video company in the country, or in the not the country, but in on the globe, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know they listened. There have only been two episodes, but they listened to those and gave me feedback. So Criterion, I think, is very careful with the way they release stuff, and I think they're smart about it. For example, Peter Becker went on a TV show and teased Silence of the Lambs about 6 months ago.
What show?
I forget the name of it. It was actually an internet show. It was like a financial show. It was very strange. But they also have their own social media presence. They do a very good job at teasing things out. There's a lot of speculation that a lot of Bergman is going to come out for his 100th birthday, if he were alive. So they've been tweeting a lot about Bergman. And now, they probably wouldn't choose Aaron West to come out and say they're going to release everything about Bergman or everything that Bergman's ever done. They want to get that out on their own. But yeah.
Right, but they need foot soldiers to help spread the word. I mean, they've got, I would imagine they can just get the word out more successfully with a number of selected. Like I say, I could describe you as a foot soldier. So, okay, so you got the whole collection. You got like the majority of the collection right after the wife won the money. So you had a foundation there to begin with. And have you caught up on them? I mean, that's a lot of Japanese film.
So that's a lot of,
right? I mean, that's a lot of international cinema. You can't have that on in the background. You got to be watching those movies.
So that's another thing, and there is a fine line between collecting and hoarding. And I personally think that if you don't consume the content that you're purchasing,
well, yeah,
you're no better. So I'll be honest that I haven't watched all. I think there's over 900 films now. I haven't watched all of them, but I think I've watched. I don't have a number, but it's in the 80%. I do watch a lot of movies. I love film, and I love international film.
Are you watching one a day, do you think?
No, maybe a few a week.
Okay.
So for the show, I at least two usually for the show. I try to squeeze in two. But, you know, if I get a three-day weekend, I'll throw a couple others in there. So, yeah, it's a great way to discover and rediscover a lot of the cinema I love. So, it's just being a film nerd. And, mm-hmm. So if a big Bergman set does come out this year, and so I basically maintain my collection by just buying the new releases now. So it's
right.
A lot less.
So a few come out, let's say, every month. How many come out on average? Do you say, like, an average, rough average?
5 or 6, generally.
Any given month.
So it's $100 $150. They just had the Olympics box set. And by the way, I have watched the entire thing.
Uh-huh. The Olympics box set, is that like vintage Olympics, like footage from broadcasts over the years? Or
100 years of Olympics. So it starts in 1912 and then it ends in 2012 with Vancouver.
So it's sort of a documentary.
It's all documentaries, yeah. So, but it's IOC, the International Olympic Committee. They have official films for each Olympic ceremony. So some of those are filmed at the time, and then the IOC kind of like puts their rubber stamp and designates them as official after the fact. They have there were about 50 so films in the collection, and I did binge watch those. It's kind of like you'd binge watch Stranger Things or Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad, mm-hmm. Game of Thrones. But for me, it was the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
To get ready to do another podcast. Mm-hmm. So
you're buying them now. Since you bought since your postman delivered the the foundation, the backlog, the archive of them, you've been keeping up more or less since then. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So I. I do get some free, I'll be honest, kind of like you, but not. I think maybe it's the shame part. If the more I ask, the more I'd get. But the thing is, I have to. If I ask for one, I have to do a review or something.
But aren't you doing it anyway? Because you're going over all the new titles.
Yeah, you know, I think you're actually making a good argument. I think
if I was over at the publicist, I would be imagining you'd be as qualified, bona fide recipient of these of all the stuff. Because I knew there was like they have like a list or used to, I don't know if they still do, but of a select group that would just get everything.
So we are on that list, and I don't mean me, Aaron West, but Criterion Cast is on that list,
right?
So and we try to have a review on the website of just about every title,
mm-hmm.
and it's not just because we have a team of maybe 5 to 10 people that circulate between the web and the and print, and so if I wanted to, I could get free stuff more,
mm-hmm.
but you know, I don't mind. I like, it's not like I'm donating to charity, but you know, the state of home media today, I don't mind giving $20 for them to do this massive restoration of this 50-year-old film I love, or you know, again, I don't know what's coming for Bergman, but mm-hmm. for them to put all these films out that I believe they're going to put out, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It's a new way of putting them out, though. So because I'm sure
putting with your wallet,
you must have every Bergman film. I'm assuming that was on Criterion anyway.
Yeah, I do have every Bergman film that's on Criterion. Now, actually, there are a few holes. I need to watch more. I'm actually waiting to get hoping that comes out. I keep on bringing Bergman up. That's he's one of my favorite filmmakers, and kind of what has me tantalized these days.
Do you have a favorite?
What's that?
Do you have a favorite, like the Bergman films?
A favorite? Persona, for sure.
Oh, Persona.
Or Shame, maybe. I actually really like Shame, which is very different from a lot of his work. But my favorite filmmaker, period, is actually Jean Renoir, which is very Criterion-ish. I think I tend to be really into French 1930s film, which is probably a little unusual.
Yeah, no. I Gabin is one of my favorite actors of all time.
I was actually corrected. It's Gabin.
Yeah, I guess that would make sense, right? Gabin.
Of course. Having a big audience, and I'm terrible with pronunciation, so I get
well with French. I should know, but I guess I do it more in the recognizable. Like, you know, I don't always go for what the proper is. If there's more universal version of it, you know, I think a lot of people would call him Gabin. Yeah,
that's just the way our mouths go in America. So I think that's the way. If you had 9 out of 10 people say his name, well, Gabin's probably the more common.
Yeah, right.
That's the way I said it until I was corrected.
Either way, though, he's one of the great actors, bar none.
He is. In fact, on social media, he's my avatar. So,
is that right?
He's who I strive to be. This is Jean Gabin. Gabin.
Gabin. And speaking of Jean Moreau is one of my favorite actresses.
Female actors.
May she rest in peace.
Yeah.
We just lost her.
Right.
She's great. I just rewatched Elevated to the Gallows not too long ago. And
yeah,
that's
I love that.
Really the film that broke her career.
Right.
That iconic scene of her walking in the rain. I've seen it so many times on the internet and on GIFs that I thought it was like 10 minutes, but it's like 10 seconds. But she's great.
Yeah, no, her performance in Elevated to the Gallows and the Antonioni, L'Eclise or is it what?
Le Noir.
La Notte, right?
La
Notte. That's the one with Mastroianni, right?
Mastroianni, yeah. And also I think there was somebody else in. Vidi was in that as well. She came in the third act. She made an appearance at a party.
Right.
Yeah. Moreau had a knack for. Well, you know, she was very smart about the roles she selected, and she picked directors. And for a while, I thought that maybe she was just tough to work with. So, you know.
I don't care. I'd put up with just about anything in her.
Truffaut's like, I'm not working with her again. So she moves on to Mall, and then she moves on to Antonioni and then Fellini. She did. If you look at her body of work in the 60s and 70s, I mean, she, like some of the best films of all time, have her above the fold there.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think she just aligned herself with some of the greatest. And I don't care how difficult she is. I'm hiring her. I'm casting her.
Oh, absolutely. Well, she was the international starlet of the 60s, I think. So her and Bardot would put butts in seats.
And, well, Catherine Deneuve.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, it was always a kind of like, were you a Deneuve or you're a Moreau? And I went for more of the Moreau. Although yeah, I love.
And then there's B.D. Loren.
Monica Vitti, who is, was she married to Antonioni?
Boy, you stumped me. I think so.
Weren't they married?
I don't know. I might have to cheat here. I can't remember.
I thought that they were an item. I think that's why she ends up in a number of his films, too. But
I know that Rossellini and Bergman were an item. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And Fellini had Giulietta, right? Massini?
Fellini had Massini, yeah. So that was his muse. And kept the iconic character from The Knights of Cabiria. Mm-hmm. And then Lestrada is what I'm thinking of.
Right. Yeah. Some of the greatest. And you have all those. So it's an incredible collection. My God.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and what's going on now is I'm very excited because now they're getting, it seems like they're getting all these seminal 70s, you know, new Hollywood films, and that's, for me, exciting. So when they started getting, like, Nashville and The Graduate and now Men Like Cowboy and it's...
And Dr. Strangelove.
I have that, too.
Kubrick, Barry Lyndon's, yeah.
Right, yeah.
They're getting great, really big titles that you wouldn't think, and I think that actually speaks more to the state of home media these days. In that a lot of these films weren't available to them 5 years ago.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's true, because what they're doing with these titles, it makes sense that they would just go to Criterion, because the other companies aren't making any money off of the DVDs anymore.
Right, yeah. So,
but because they have more of a mass market functionality, whereas Criterion does not.
At least not.
Yes, yeah, so a studio could put out Dr. Strangelove and sell it for $10 on Amazon and... And there have been a lot of those versions, but
yes.
Criterion will record a few special features, and it'll show up as one of the top sellers in of all films on Blu-ray. So yeah, they do have a lot of marketing power, and I think they've done a good job creating their brand.
Right. Yeah, because they got the attention and the following of the art, you know, the cinephile, whereas obviously. Whatever other companies that's using Amazon or whatever, then they're not going to have that. They're not going to enjoy that relationship quite.
Yeah, it's still a big deal when a movie gets Criterion treatment, I think. Not a big deal if Warner Archive, nothing against Warner Archive, they're great, but, you know, that's, or Kino Lorber, they put out good, really good movies, but yeah, you're not going to find a lot of Kino Lorber completionists. So.
Did you talk about Charles Cohen recently and his acquiring of art films?
I think Cohen's quite a interesting aspect of not just classic film, but modern film too. You know, I have talked about him on the podcast, mm-hmm. but yeah, he's a billionaire. I believe he made his money in real estate.
Yes, so he comes from a real estate family. Yeah.
And up in your neck of the woods.
And he's been on my show.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah, I had him on.
I'll have to listen to that episode.
Because he's distributed, you know, Faces Places.
Oh, okay. So basically what I'm doing by buying the Criterion Collection, just because out of passion, he's kind of doing that on a much larger scale. You know, take the Jeopardy analogy and ratchet it up to billionaire real estate mogul. So he's basically acquiring films and putting them out. And I think he's probably taking losses on a lot of them. I don't think he won like all the Merchant Ivory. Oh, I say won. You know, he did win. He bought them, took some of them from Criterion.
Mm-hmm.
Probably paid a price that would not have been viable for them. So I'm thankful for Charles Cohen. I'll be honest. I don't like his graphic design work on his home media, but he is bringing a lot of good films to the States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Varda was his, and he does a lot of very much art house, and so I can't imagine that there's any profits. And he owns the Quad Cinema.
Oh, he does. I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah,
I think I could have a beer with Mr. Cohen, or maybe a wine.
It would probably be wine, and he'd have to be buying, I'm sure.
Absolutely. It's on him. So next time I'm in New York, let's the three of us go up to a rooftop bar somewhere.
Right.
Oh, yeah, just hang out. Well, you know, and I know somebody who worked for him, or a couple of people, but he would insist on everyone wearing suits to meetings.
Okay. Yeah. Well, my workplace is a little more casual, but I do have a few suits, so I'd make sure to pack those. Not as nice as his, I'm sure.
Yeah, give a listen to that segment. I'm curious to know what you think.
Absolutely. I think he's... and there's room for people like him. And I think that's it's says something about home media that somebody like him can make such a dramatic impression just by, you know, spending a little money. And to him, it really is a little money. It's not much.
True. Coming. We could talk about what's coming up. Maybe there's stuff coming episode. Up. You can talk about now. Are you doing anything special for the 50th episode? Or
it's a. I'm going to – well, my partner in crime has been Mark Kearney. I don't know if you've heard him on my show. He has a very deep radio voice. Like, you know, he could do traditional radio, like drive time, morning
– Criterion chatter.
Yes. So I think we complement each other well, but he's not available to be on every show, so I've kind of taken the reins. Mm-hmm. But I have him on special shows, and he does some of the bonus episodes with me. So he's going to be on the 50th episode, and I told him to invite – whoever he wants. So I think he's still thinking about who he wants to have. So he has some connections to podcasting, Film Spotting. I don't know if you know them, but they're another early podcast, and we've done a podcast with Josh Larson.
Oh yeah, he's great.
Yeah, good guys. And there's another Chicago podcast that we're friends with. So yeah, maybe one of them, or maybe one of our friends. You know, but. As far as the content, I think it just depends on what happens. Now, I will say that we do episodes on Arrow. Mm-hmm. If something Bergman happens, we'll have to do something special for that. But we just talk home media, and we love doing it.
Well, you do an exceptional job. As I said, I become a regular listener myself, and
thank you.
Keeps me up to date on all things Criterion. If you know, as much as I try to myself, it's not easy because I'm constantly, you know, trying to keep up with contemporary cinema and festivals and everything else. So you guys are helping quite a bit, especially yourself. And it was a lot of fun. I just did your podcast, and is that episode 48? I forget.
Yeah, that's 48. 48. Yeah, there it is. Yeah.
And that's a good example. So we just basically shot the shit for an hour and a half. You know, we had topics, but we just kind of like went wherever we wanted to go. And that's I think that's the best podcast personally, and kind of like you and I are doing right now. We just have a conversation, and you know, it's just two guys talking about what they love. And sometimes we have three, four people. I try to mix up the guests.
Yeah. No, and it's also another way to also find out just who's in this community by listening to your show, listen to James Hancock's show, which is also just choosing sometimes a film or a filmmaker or a year in film and kind of just doing a deep dive into it. It's a great kind of way to find out all the people that he gets on. There's this community of cinephiles. This is the greatest way to discover each other. And, you know, I don't know, we should all somehow or other have a big party someday.
We should absolutely have that. I'm actually going to be on James's show in a couple of weeks.
Oh, great.
We're going to be talking about the state of digital versus home media. So I have a few things to say about that.
I can't wait to hear it.
You asked about what we're coming out with. I can't believe I almost forgot, but we're launching a new podcast called Waves.
Waves.
Yes. In fact, I can't believe it slipped my mind. It's one of the most important things I'm working on. But this is a little different than Criterion Now. What we're doing is we're actually looking at film movements. So you brought up Italian film.
Mm-hmm.
So our first season is going to be Italian neorealism.
Oh, great. So Bicycle Thieves, that kind of thing.
What's that?
Bicycle Thieves and...
The War Trilogy. We'll get into Fellini, Antonioni.
Fettuccine.
Visconti.
Rigatoni.
Fettuccine.
Got it.
Yeah. And what we would like to do is, so we're going to do one season for each movement. So we're going to do about 10 episodes or so on the Italian neorealism. And then we're going to move on to, like, maybe we'll do American New Wave, or maybe we'll do something crazy like J-horror, or maybe like, I don't know, maybe grindhouse slasher films,
right? Yeah, and then there's what is it, Von Trier's and the guys over in Denmark and
Dogma 95. That would be a great show. We have like a list of about 20 different seasons, and we only have so much time.
Right.
But yeah, so I'm actually prepping, you know, reading books about Italian cinema as we speak.
Yeah.
Well, not literally as we speak, but it's a good way to. Kind of take all this film watching and put it into something that's helpful. And I think of myself as a film student and aspire to be a film teacher. So it's a little bit of a film history that I'm trying to pass to my audience. And that's one show I'm doing with Mark.
Speaking of film history, do you know Karina Longworth's podcast? You must remember this.
Yes, I do. I think she does a great job.
Oh, she's has a real scholarly approach to her show, which is all about the first 100 years of the Hollywood, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and you know, I haven't thought about that. I do listen to her show somewhat regularly, but I wasn't really influenced by her for this project. But I was actually more influenced by Serial, and it's not like we're not going to reveal a murder on episode 9, but
or not reveal one.
And I think that's kind of the fad now in podcasting is to do seasons and to build up to something. But what we'd like is for the show. So Criterion, even though it's a subject that's close to my heart, you know, with the whole Jeopardy story, but it's not something like this. What you and I talked about today is not going to be current 6 months from now. So I want to create something that will last for
evergreen.
Somebody can listen to 5, 10 years from now. I don't know if podcasts will exist by then. We'll see.
Something that's evergreen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think there's levels to it. I mean, I think for some of us, we're kind of freaks. So in fact, I would probably find old Criterion conversations equally interesting, but I don't think 99% of the universe out there would feel the same way. But you're right. Something that's more evergreen would probably make much more sense to for the majority of listeners.
Yeah, so we date ourselves pretty quick. Our back catalog, I actually would cringe listen to it, but it's more about the experience. So we just enjoy putting it on. We have a good community that enjoys listening to it. So so yeah, it's like a nice. I made this terrible joke the other day. It's the human centipede of cinephilia.
I do look at my show though as possibly the way the Criterion looks at content in some level, not to compare the two, but in that I can imagine repackaging segments that I've done.
Yeah, you could go back to 20, 30, 40 episodes. Your episodes are evergreen for sure.
I don't know. I prefer that I would just have people on and not have to heavily market or promote a particular film that they're just working on now, but that's mainly how you get them on, so you have to do it. On another level, though, even there, I almost invariably sneak in a lot of other stuff or try to.
Yeah. Well, we both had Sean Baker on our shows, and so with Sean, I did talk to him about the Florida Project and Tangerine, but I also wanted his opinions on film, and I think he loved doing the show, and I'm sure he loved doing your show, too. He's a great guy.
Yeah, I know he's a listener, or he said he was, and I have no reason to doubt his word. And then I almost got him back on for the Florida Project. It didn't happen. And then even subsequently, he was in town doing, and we were supposed to do something together at the Nighthawk Cinema. And then that too kind of, I think it ended up where it wasn't going to be helpful to me too much. So I just sort of ended up not doing it because I had it's busy.
He did have a busy year, and on his behalf, I'll say he was robbed. Should have been Best Picture nominee, but
yeah, no, and I think we'll see. You know, I've been watching a lot of Schrader, so Willem Dafoe has been in my peer review quite a bit recently because he was a regular actor in Paul Schrader films, and now he's still as relevant as ever. That Willem Dafoe,
great American
and
actors.
He might lose this week. Oh, by the way, when is this episode going to come out? Before or after the Oscars?
Likely after, just given how tight everything is. But I don't know. It's a good question. I things are a little bit more fluid because, you know, all the moving parts that I have in terms of...
Sure. Well, I guess we'll have to record one for whether he won or whether he lost. I'm not kidding.
Right now, yeah. Congratulations to Mr. Dafoe on his win.
Mr. Dafoe / Rockwell,
Right.
So we actually talked about Three Billboards a little bit on our show, and I think it's tough to compare those two performances just because I think Rockwell is almost a lead, really, in his film. He is really good. I'm not as big a fan of Three Billboards as I am The Florida Project, but I think Dafoe did more with less, is in my opinion. So my vote would be for Dafoe.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I think so, too. I think I lean towards him. It's interesting, if you've seen Light Sleeper, the Schrader film, they're both in that. Even though Sam Rockwell has a very, 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 very brief scene in it, he's in it as well, as with Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, I like Sam Rockwell quite a bit. I think it's interesting how his career has worked out. I think he got his break on Galaxy Quest, wasn't it?
Maybe that's
I think so. Mm-hmm. But he's kind of been, and he did Confessions of a Dangerous Mind and a few other films. But
Moon, that was great. He's had a few leading parts, but he's never really quite morphed into the leading man.
No, but I think he's always done really solid work. I'm happy for him that he's nominated and very possibly will win or slash won.
Yeah, and you know, he's somebody who might develop in his older years as a quite an interesting character actor. Because maybe that's really what he is, and sometimes...
Maybe the millennial's Anthony Hopkins.
Well, I'm just saying, like, interesting how a lot of people that are meant to be character actors, but because of the way they see themselves and then the way their support network of hired support network, rather, like their management, etc., they're trying to get the big dollars, they're trying to make him into a leading man. But, you know, it's at odds with their own instincts, the actor. So Sam Rockwell is somebody like that. And interesting, Willem Dafoe is another guy who's really a character actor, but managed because of the choices he makes to be the lead in many films.
Yeah, and I'd say they both take risks. You know, Dafoe absolutely. Worked with Lars von Trier, and he did Antichrist and Nymphomaniac. So, and he played the lead in both of those.
Right. Sam Rockwell does a lot more comedies.
He does. I think of him as, and they're both great actors, but mm-hmm. I think Dafoe actually, I don't know if you know much about his theatrical background, but he, I'd say a better acting pedigree. Sure. I think he brings more to it. Not to knock Rockwell at all. I think Rockwell does a fine job.
Right.
But also, Dafoe's also been around. He now is, I think, who Rockwell is aspiring to be.
Right.
Three or four nominations, I think.
Yeah. It's hard to believe. I mean, Dafoe looks like he's, you know, 57, 58 in that movie. He's got to be 10 years older than that.
Yeah, yeah. He's also done Spider-Man, too. So.
Exactly.
He's been a villain. We took this, took a left turn, and I think that's the...
It was going to be, the name of the show is Filmax Radio, but it might have been the left turn just as easily, you know, because it's all about left turns here. You end up, if you do enough of them, you end up in the same direction, so it's okay. Thank you so much, Aaron West.
Thank you, Adam Shartoff. Not Adam West. We made that joke on our show.
That's right. And by the way, there was another guy we talked about. We mentioned, Stan Lee, whomever.
Black Panther.
So. Right. There's that and everything. But he, for years, you know, he was very into Batman and not surprisingly, but he was really into, because it's funny and it's more innocent, the Adam West, you know, like series was big, and I got him actually a box set. I don't believe it was on the Criterion, but the first and second seasons of the Batman
60s
Batman show. He loved it because it's
I have that box set. It's terrific. I wouldn't think about buying that. It's weird how things hold up, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
You showed him Chaplin?
You mean Geraldine Chaplin? Or no, kidding. Charlie Chaplin?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting that a lot of kids, he might be a little too old for Chaplin now, but a lot of kids really do can laugh at the old silent comedy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely true. Yeah, he might have missed that a little bit. But he may have seen some of that stuff in other areas, like maybe not me, but like at school or something. He's seen some stuff through the school like that, you know. But I was going to say he got really into the Batman. So Adam West was, and I was trying to get, because Adam West was doing some other podcasts like Gilbert Gottfried's, and I was trying to get, and I was on Twitter, Adam West. So I was trying to get him on to connect and maybe try to figure out how to do even a call in, just, you know, to get him on my podcast,
great voice.
Just for my kids' sake.
A better voice than Adam West?
Right, absolutely. True.
You know, I didn't even think about it. I should have tried to get him on my podcast, just because I called Adam West my entire life. So, but may he rest in peace. That's one thing. Yeah. When he passed, a lot of people said, I'm sorry to hear it. Sorry for your loss. So I'm like, I don't know the dude.
You felt more a loss when Jean Moreau died, oddly enough. But.
I did, yeah. So, or when Bergman and Antonioni died on the same day.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. That's a way to bring it.
That's like when Michael Jackson and Farrah Fawcett.
Oh, yeah.
That was the same day. I may be wrong.
I forget.
Was it within 24 hours?
Yeah, and I remember Farrah Fawcett died, and then somebody else that was bigger kind of like took the headlines.
I think it was Michael Jackson.
Yeah, I think you're right. Michael Jackson, yeah. For a second, I thought you said Glenda Jackson.
I think she is still alive, right?
She is.
Why isn't she working?
She in Parliament or something? Isn't she in
Parliament? Oh, that's what happened. Because I'm like wondering, why isn't she like one of the grand dames? Like, you know, Diana Rigg got all her parts.
Yeah,
and Maggie Smith
left the business. Yeah, why not? Drop the mic and go into politics. So,
for sure.
Never mind. Don't do that.
Yeah, exactly. I wish that didn't happen as often as it seems to. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Thanks, Adam. Break somebody's heart tonight. I feel so good. I'm gonna take someone apart tonight. They put me in jail for my deviant ways. 2 years, 7 months, and 16 days. Now I'm back.
Hogan's, this is made a Confessions of a Superhero some time ago, which I believe I saw at South by Southwest about 3 or 4 years ago. He's back with a new documentary. It's very moving. Many of the students who attend Bowie High School in El Paso, Texas, have an unusual commute to school over the bridge and across the border that separates their school from their homes in Juarez, Mexico. For many of these students, sports represent one possible route to a better life. Eric, a soccer player, dreams of playing professionally. Cheyenne, one of the school's best wrestlers, sees the Army as a way to get to college, but begins to rethink her course in the current political climate. And Francisco, a hard-throwing pitcher and third baseman whose father isn't allowed into the United States, plays each game with that absence in the back of his mind. Matt Ogan's observational documentary, Home and Away, follows each of these students as they navigate academics and athletic competition while also contending with language barriers, a school in need of greater funding and familial strife during their final years at Bowie. There will be four screenings at the Tribeca Film Festival, the first being on 1 o'clock p.m. on Saturday, April the 21st at Cinepolis in Chelsea. And then there's one screening at 6:45 on Sunday, the 22nd at Regal Cinemas in Battery Park, as well as one on the 23rd and the 28th of April, all at the Regal Cinemas Battery Park. Go to the Tribeca Film Festival website. Again, it's called Home and Away. This is my conversation with the very talented Matt Ogan's here on Film Wax Radio.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. And you're in Los Angeles at the moment?
I am. I'm based here.
What neighborhood are you in?
I live in Venice.
Oh, okay. I've been there a few times. I'm glad that Jackie put us together. And again, I do apologize. I was just so quick that I usually, if I don't put it right away in my calendar, I can just think something like that can happen where I totally...
It's all good, man.
I know. I'm glad you're still there and we're able to do it. You have a new documentary. I am
Home and Away is premiering.
Home and Away.
In April 21st is our premiere at Tribeca Film Festival.
Your world premiere, in fact.
World premiere.
Yeah, at Cinepolis, wherever they pronounce it, at 1 o'clock on Saturday, April 21st. You have like 11, 12, 13 screenings or something. Really load them up.
We have a bunch, yeah.
I guess I've been going to Tribeca forever. I guess you know what they put on the P&I screenings. That's why it looks like so.
Yeah, we have four regular screenings and then two press and industry screenings.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's an auspicious premiere. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It means a lot to us.
Yeah, you put in a lot of work, and when you actually get a premiere at a festival that's really as filmmaker-friendly, where they're going to obviously do a lot to put the word out about your film, that's got to be a good feeling.
Yeah, it's good reward.
Yeah. So, again, you mentioned already it's called Home and Away. You came on my radar with Confessions of a Superhero a couple of years back, which also was at Tribeca, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that premiered at South by Southwest.
Do not correct me on my own podcast.
Okay.
Okay, so it was at South by Southwest. Very good. Well, maybe I saw it there then that year. Anyway, regardless, I saw it. So when I saw that you were the same film, it was another reason I said, yes, let's do this, because it's only a matter of time. Let's face it. You're going to be on the podcast, so let's just...
Yeah, get it over with.
Not over with, but let's do
it.
In
a good way.
Yeah, very much so. I watched it the other day. Very moving, I have to say. I was all choked up by the end of it. Rooting for these young people who are just on the cusp of their lives, and there's so many challenges in front of them. And you have shown their first opportunity to grab the challenge and make a success or not, you know? And we're living it with them during the course of the film.
In real time.
Yeah. You know, first of all, talk a little bit. I mean, you shot this in a town just on the southern border of Texas?
Yeah, so we shot in El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
Right.
I was looking for, you know, what's the closest or one of the closest high schools in America to the Mexican border as a microcosm of everything going on about the border. And I found this great high school called Bowie High School, which is, gosh, it's got to be about 50 yards from the border.
That's incredible.
It's right there. And when I dug deeper, I found out that all along the border, that there's such a back and forth of people between sister cities on both sides of the border, and that there are many kids that live in Juarez full-time or part-time that go to school in the United States in the hopes of a better future, which is what I found unique, because oftentimes we see the news, we see the topic of the border, but we rarely humanize the border and see how the people, we talk about it up here, and sort of cast judgments on one way or the other without really understanding life on the border. And I was trying to paint a picture of life on the border, and I thought, what better way than high school kids coming of age, you know, trying to figure out their lives complicated by the border, and using sports as a metaphor for life, as an outlet for them, as a way to prove themselves. So kind of using sports as a narrative arc for the film.
What is your relationship, just as a small sidebar, and then we'll come right back to Home and Away, your relationship to sports? I noticed that you did a 30 for 30, which is most people who are not aware of this, you know, years-long series that ESPN has been producing where they bring in the most talented documentary filmmakers.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of people on my show, like Barbara Koppel and Steve James and so many others, the very top of the documentary food chain, who have done these, some of their best work on that series.
I did a 30 for 30 on the Harlem Globetrotters.
That's pretty amazing.
You know, I don't consider myself a sports filmmaker, but I have done a decent amount of sports documentary work, among other things. And I guess the reason I've done a lot of sports stuff is because sports content is because I think whether you're a sports fan or not, sports can be such a great metaphor for life. You know,
right.
In that one game or
yep.
season, it sort of can parallel the ups and downs of life, and it builds character in all of
especially
with young people, which is why it was very important in this film that sports was, you know, a part of their lives. And it was very important to them. Sports was really important to them. But, you know, I try when I do sports content to do sports content for non-sports fans.
Well, that's what 30 for 30 is all about. It's
crossover, transcend sports and have more meaning. But it's not about the stats or the score of the game as much as how it affects the people and sort of behind the scenes of sports.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's, I think, what that series is really essentially doing, you know, if nothing else. So, and it, as you mentioned already, it does that effectively in Home and Away, which is a nice double entendre or, you know, nice wordplay there, right? Because it can stand for, of course, away games and home games, but it also is, yeah, about life, of course.
Yeah, so, but they are American citizens, so many... I see.
Right, they have one parent.
Yeah, many pregnant mothers that aren't U.S. citizens, live so close to the border maybe they're working in Texas. And when they give birth, they end up in a hospital in Texas, and the hospital's going to not turn them away. So even though the parent, the mother and father, in many cases, are not U.S. citizens, because their kid is born in the United States, they are entitled to an American education. And a lot of these families living on the border have families on both sides of the border. So a lot of these kids will live with another family member in the States to be able to go to school in the United States. And, you know, they'll live with their parents on weekends or part of the week and live with a cousin or a grandparent or an uncle or an aunt. Or in some cases, like Francisco in the film, his parents are married, but his dad lives in Juarez and can't come across. His mom lives in El Paso just so her kids can be closer to school and not have to walk through what could be very dangerous in Juarez, where there's a lot of cartel violence. So she sacrificed sort of affecting her marriage for her kids.
Yeah, this is a subject that is coming up more and more. How many families are affected by economic choices like that?
Look at Eric in the film when he graduates. I don't want to give too much away of the film, but
you gave away he graduated.
Yeah, they can't come see him graduate. They can't see him play soccer. You know, they can't be there and see the highlights of high school.
But the kids, that's disappointing. But they also see the sacrifice that their parents make. In some cases.
Yeah, they're hoping, them and their families are hoping that getting an education in the United States may be a way out to be successful, to be happy, and to help their families. You know, even if they remain in Mexico, maybe to get that education and bring what they learned back with them.
So you shot, there's three primary subjects.
Yes.
In your film, you mentioned Eric Espinoza. Who's the soccer player, correct?
Yeah, so Eric lives mainly in Juarez and has family in El Paso and plays soccer, senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Cheyenne is a wrestler. Girl who lives in El Paso, who is a wrestler, is also senior.
And Francisco.
And then Francisco's a junior. I guess you'd say the border divides his family. You know, his mom lives in El Paso and his dad lives in Juarez.
Well, that particular thread or part of the film, of course, is heightened because he's on a team that hasn't won in decades.
Over years, yeah.
And so, you know, not only is this are there personal stories here, but there's also another story about the team and also the town and about, you know, the coaches. And it's a very exciting, nice part of the film to get caught up with.
Yes.
Yeah. So how did you meet these three or choose? Did you have more kids originally and you came down to these three?
Well, I went for about a week before I started really filming just to get the lay of the land and I guess you could say cast. And I just met with tons of kids from each of the teams. I met with one after another and would just sit down with them in a room and just have a conversation and see what was going on in their lives, if they were comfortable being part of the film, because you want to make sure you have sort of, they're going to let you in and be comfortable. And we did end up filming five characters, but there wasn't enough screen time.
Because
the other two weren't great. They were fantastic. Just there's only so much you can fit in one film.
That's when you have to say, but hey, we were able to do bonus content now with the way things work. So, you know, it's a little less disappointing. Because all of a sudden you have, you know, these three young folks, Eric and Francisco and Cheyenne, and you're saying, we're going to one of the major film festivals in the world, and I'm sure they're going to want to come and be at the premiere.
They are coming.
Okay, so people, let's just write this in again into your calendars. Saturday, April 21st is your world premiere, but there's a few more screenings on Sunday, April the 22nd at 6:45. You have one on Monday, April 23rd at 5:15, and then a last one on Saturday, April 28th. It's right here in front of me. I didn't memorize this. It's 5 o'clock. So there's no excuse. If you're in the New York area, you can come see Home and Away, directed by Matt Ogens, who's a documentary filmmaker. Do you have any desires to do a narrative at some point? Or maybe you already have, and I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right now I'm developing a lot of documentary series projects.
They seem to be a real there seems to be a real appetite for that.
Hello? Yeah, mm-hmm. I have a documentary series on the air right now called Why We Fight. It's on Verizon's Go 90 network, their streaming platform.
Mm-hmm.
Just got nominated.
I've heard about that.
Award last week for it.
You what? Say
we
again?
Just got nominated for an Emmy Award for it last week. And so I'm pitching a lot and developing a lot of documentary series mm-hmm. that I'm really passionate about. And, of course, I'm looking for the right narrative project. And I gravitate towards dramas based on the documentary work. And I gravitate towards stories that are based on true stories. So I think it will be, you know, a nice transition for me.
Mm-hmm. And I guess at Tribeca might be a nice maybe there's some opportunities there to figure out next steps with your film.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Is hopefully well, fingers crossed. But it seems like there should be spots that would be eager to have that.
You know, so I want people to see this. I think that there's a big audience for this,
and I think it's really timely right now. Let's face it.
Yeah.
It's not a small, you know, while others are focusing on putting up even worse barriers between countries, your film does the opposite.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you want to root for these kids. So I think there's a huge audience for teenagers mm-hmm. to watch this and relate to it and see how other people live and empathize and really just get to understand through these three kids what life on the border is like, at least for them.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful story. Again, I'm glad that I just was able to see it. And I think you should send a Vimeo link to hashtag Unstable POTUS.
No problem.
I think he could benefit from watching your film. If
you
have a 2 or 3 minute version of it, maybe like,
I don't know if he has the attention span.
Yeah, exactly. Well, all three of your subjects are winners. They all succeed because, you know, they're all smart and have goals and want more out of life and want to please their families and their, you know, it all comes through. You chose three very good subjects for the film.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, you're
welcome. Well, they did the work, most of the work.
What did you show to them already or their families?
This will be the first time I see it.
You nervous? In a good way.
Yeah. But I am, but I think they'll like it. You know, I don't think any of them come off poorly.
Not at
all.
It'll
be interesting. I'm curious. I'm not nervous.
There is one scene with, I think Francisco. No. Eric. Did I get the name right?
Which one?
Well, of course, I haven't said that. Where of course, he has a paper he's supposed to hand in.
Oh, Eric, yeah.
It is Eric, right? And this is, again, I think is he the baseball player?
Soccer,
excuse me, Eric Espinoza. And he's, right, and you have some shot right in there.
Dangerously close to not graduating.
Right. I was thinking about him, and I'm just thinking, the amount of pressure, you could just see it. You know, you don't need him to say it, because You just read it on this young man's face. He's so much is on the line. He's trying to do so much. He has so much pressure, and you know he's got to write this. He's late with a paper. It's supposed to be autobiographical, but instead he decided he's going to write about Syria.
Yeah.
You just get a sense that this kid is, he's put so much pressure on himself, you know. It's a very human moment. And the teacher, and then he hands it, I mean, I don't want to give anything away. All I can tell you is there's a subsequent scene, right, where with the same teacher, you know, it's just a real beautiful moment where he just expresses his pride in Eric. And
yeah,
you know, you were there for that. It must be you realize as you're shooting this moment, you must realize what gold you've been able to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we shot, gosh, probably over 400 hours of footage.
Mm.
There's so much that isn't in the film that I wish was, but it would be a very long film.
Yeah, well, that's a subject in of itself. That's a segment for a podcast right there.
Yeah.
How you can... Did you edit this? I don't even remember.
Didn't personally edit it. Our main editor is a guy named Dan Schulman-Means, who's great. Andrew Fredericks was a co-editor, and then we had additional editors, Mel Rodriguez, Syra Hader, Tanya Levy, and Christian Aris. Mm. So it was a pretty monumental task, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you had a big team there, I noticed, a number of shooters and camera folks.
Yeah, John Tipton was our main director of photography. He shot most of it.
Okay.
But in a doc, it's, you know,
yeah,
a lot of moving parts.
Sometimes you have to be in three places at once, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Or more, yeah. Five subjects.
Sometimes we're shooting multiple things at the same time, and we need to split our crews up, absolutely.
Right. Very good. Okay, well, as I mentioned, you can go to the Tribeca Film Festival site and find all the details where Home and Away will have its world premiere. And you can meet...
Yes.
You can meet Matt and some of his subjects if you get there. I'm gathering in one of the first screenings.
You probably at least the first one.
Yeah.
On the 21st.
Sure. Right.
Possibly the second as well on the 22nd.
Got it. Nice meeting you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Anytime. Come back again anytime you want.
Hope so. Yeah, I'd love great. To.
And maybe I'll run into you in New York.
I'd love to.
Right.
That'd be great.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
But pulled in just behind the bridge. He lays her down. He frowns. Gee, my life's a funny thing. Am I still too?
Thanks, everybody, for your time, and we will be back on Thursday with a new episode. For instance, we have the filmmaker Chloe Zhao and the subject of her new film. It's called The Rider, and his name is Brady Jandrew, and they've had an incredible trajectory with their film, The Rider. It was at, I think, a world premiere at Cannes, where it won one of the top prizes, and it went on to have its U.S. premiere at Telluride. It was at TIFF. It was at Sundance, South By. It's just been one of the most remarkable trajectories I've ever seen for a film. And we'll have them on the next episode. So let me just get this current episode up and out. So until then, do take care of yourselves and the ones you love.
Broken strings, broken idols, broken heads.